Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. The demand for energy is growing by the day in Ohio, fueled by power-hungry data centers and more people and companies putting down roots here. Stoking concerns about future blackouts and higher costs unless steps are taken to reform how Ohio is powered. One solution is a major investment in energy technology innovation. Bright Energy Innovators is a startup that aims to power energy innovation through programs that provide support for other startups in the energy technology sector. Joining us now is Jade Davis, who serves as Bright's CEO. Welcome to All Sides, Jade.
Hey, thanks for having me, Amy.
So you call Bright an ecosystem for advanced energy. So tell me about that. What is advanced energy?
Well, you know, Bright, just to give you a little bit of background, Bright Energy Innovators, we are the state's advanced energy incubator. We help companies throughout Ohio and for a lot of companies outside of Ohio as well, bring their IP to commercialization, whether that's hardware, whether that's software, and that is helping innovators in our startup programs who may have an idea, a technology they're trying to create a business out of. We help them, give them the intellectual capacity and the help and all the structure to get that business set up, all the way to companies that are looking to either exit via IPO or to gather enough financing in order to go to full-scale production and operations once they receive their first customers and clients and things of that nature. So the key with Bright, though, and I think incubators around the country, is that we help provide solutions to the problems of today and the problems that are going to persist tomorrow as well. And so that's what we try to work on with our ecosystem, with all the companies of various parts of the energy ecosystem related fields.
So give me an example of a problem that you help solve. Is it the problem money? Is the problem regulation? Is the problem just like getting things off the ground?
All of that and more.
Okay. So, I just made up three problems.
No,
yeah.
No, but as it, with any complex issue, there are going to be a range of ways in which you have to deal with that issue in order to actualize full success. Fundraising, we do help companies fundraise and help them either through work with our relationships with equity and angel investors and venture funds and things of that nature, banks, traditional lenders. But we also are helping those companies have the kind of technical expertise within their companies that can from providing the CFO services, from providing marketing services. Mm. Some companies we provide the CEO for, like a company that may just have a board and technology and they're trying to spin it out from a separate entity. And we provide that kind of leadership and structure in which they can go and build and get to those points. So startups and early stage, middle stage, later stage startups need very different things oftentimes, and we help provide some of those things.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how early in the process, but it sounds like you even help things get off the ground. Like you don't even have to be necessarily an established company to need help.
Yes. And if you think about it, all of our great companies and some of our unicorns and the most valuable companies all start in like garages, dorm rooms, basements, the back of a manufacturing facility or something like that, and end up becoming what we now know today, an Apple or a Microsoft, or when you think of, heck, even if you're in Worthington, Lincoln Electric, when you think of some of our big employers throughout just Ohio, many of those started from ideas, from getting a patent and all those kind of things. So we help in companies that are tinkering, per se, all the way to companies that already have significant revenues, employee base, but to grow.
Let's give an example. One of the startups you've backed is called Canon. Am I saying that right? K-A-N-I-N.
Yeah.
Canon.
Yeah.
Canon Energy, a waste to heat startup. So they are doing a project with the University of Dayton. Can you tell me about that? Maybe start with what waste to heat means.
Well, it can mean very different things with various different technologies. Sometimes you're using like everything from garbage waste or heating oil or cooking oil waste or animal waste and things like that, and you're turned into heat through maybe anaerobic digestion or a thing. I'm trying not to get too technical, companies like that, or when you think about even Galvanics per se, as well as another company we work with that's working with rare earth minerals and processing those rare earth minerals. The technologies that they are working on are things that we are dealing with today. And not only are we dealing with that today, being able to process rare earth minerals here in America and be able to have greater capacity to do that is going to give us an edge in not only lowering the price of power or the price of electronics, but also being able to get the manufacturing and job opportunities that come with that, right? That's going on right now in Neela Park in East Cleveland, Ohio. When you think about Canon, the work that they're doing there, when you think about forward deployment of power and electricity from waste that can become a element of the Department of Defense and what they need when they're looking at forward operations in the field, whether it's bases around the world or if that's training bases here in the U.S. and being able to have that here in Ohio as being produced, headquartered here. Those are kind of, again, not only job opportunities, but also when you think of the other capital and ancillary products and companies that come with those kind of developments. That's what we're working on at Bright, trying to make sure that ecosystem is supported to get to those points.
Yeah, and with Canon, I mean, they are using this waste to heat to power. Right now, they're powering administrative buildings at the University of Dayton. But you're talking even bigger picture, because you just mentioned, like, so this is where it starts, but you're looking toward helping them grow.
Yeah, and also when you think about powering administrative buildings, what does that look like when you think of data centers? Mm. What does that look like when you think of hospitals? When you think of schools and just some of the demands financially that they're facing? And if this is something that can help them produce, you know, power more efficiently, effectively, maybe cheaper, those are things that we can look at and that we need to innovate around.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about ways to help support energy startups with Bright Energy Innovators CEO Jade Davis. Another area you've been working in is battery technology, something which is very important to many businesses. Can you tell me a little bit more about Bright's involvement in battery technology?
So it's funny. If you go back 15 or so years ago when Bright first started in Mahoning Valley, as sort of the tech belt energy center, battery technology around transportation was one of the key things that the nonprofit was really started to help sort of help there in Mahoning Valley, as we spread out now throughout as being the state's incubator with more capacity and staff around the state. The battery technology piece is going to be critical, not only for transportation. The reason it's critical is because we're not going to be in a society where we're going to need less electrons. Mm. We're going to need more electrons. We're going to need more variable types of electrons. As people continue to plug in more cars, more devices, plugging in more homes, and when you look at battery storage and things of that nature, just on a residential that Bob and Betty Buckeye is using. Then when you start thinking about the bigger commercial needs from AI, and I'm not just talking AI as in like large scale sort of amorphous companies. I'm talking about that the fact that me and you and probably a lot of people listening to this are storing a lot of pictures on the phones of our children, of our family, of our college buddies and things of that nature, of our nice garden that we work so hard on our yard in the summertime. I know it looks a long way from summer right now, being January 20th here. But these kind of things, those kind of amenities that we've now become used to, has come kind of ubiquitous in our lives, have to be stored somewhere, have to be powered somewhere. So this battery technology, I would say, is going to be at the forefront of how we use power going forward for the next 50 to 100 years. We're working with companies like PetroPower to do that. Another company has spun out of Bright. Electrata is looking at EV fleet charging and utilizing battery technology for that. But we're also working with a lot of data center adjacent ancillary services in order to help them actualize and maximize the efficiency of battery power in order to supply power that they need, especially during peak and especially during times in which power prices are high, which is now.
And we should say that your company is Bright, B-R-I-T-E, not
yes.
not Bright like B-R-I-G-H-T.
Yeah.
So it is B-R-I-T-E. Did you make up an acronym or is it just you like the word Bright?
No, you know what? it's not an acronym. It's really just talking about the bright horizons of energy, of what we need to do in energy. Now, look, it's going to be hard. It's going to be innovating is not easy. Not every single company, not every single innovation is going to be successful or stick. But the horizon of energy and the need and the investment that's being made is going to result in more power, is going to result in better pricing and things like that as we innovate and make these innovations cheaper and more cost competitive.
Let's talk about Ohio's current energy landscape. Ohio's Republican-led legislature has emphasized traditional energy methods over what is known as clean energy. Clean energy, we think wind and solar, and nuclear has been embraced more recently. But the focus at the state house level has been natural gas most recently. Mm-hmm. So what does this mean for your company when you think about where the focus is at the state level?
Well, Bright, we focus on all advanced energy technologies are going to be cleaner, plain and simple. They're going to be more efficient. They're going to have less waste, less emissions, period. But what we're focused on is the innovations around that. We do a lot of work with carbon sequestration companies now in the southeast United States and helping them stand up technologies. We're doing a lot of work with solar firms right now and helping them and adapt AI and software into their development of films and batteries to sort of supplement with their power. We also do a lot with natural gas companies as well with emissions tracking, reduction, and energy liners and things like that for turbines and things of that nature. So we're very much involved in everything that people might consider traditional energy and all the way to our advanced cleaner energy, renewable energy sources. So we're running the whole gamut of it. What we have seen though is that energy is such a critical need and topic right now. The investment and the innovation is happening in all aspects of it. We really do need all of it. We need all of it. We need all of it to bridge. We need all of it in order to innovate. And we also need all this energy in order to stabilize our grid, improve the grid, and make it more resilient. The grid is probably not going to look like what it does now in 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. Those innovations have started long before now, and they're going to continue. And so, again, the legislative or political focus may be on that, but the focus of the entire industries, including some of those companies that are in oil, gas, are going to be in everything and developing everything and bringing it all to bear. We're operating in that entire ecosystem.
I've done many shows about data centers. Ohio mm-hmm. is becoming the center of data centers for a lot of the United States. And there's a lot of speculation that like we need all of these huge data centers right now, but in that 50-year that we'll be able to make them, we'll be able to do it all smaller. Someone will figure out how to make it better, to advance it mm-hmm. more. So what are your thoughts on where we are currently with the data centers and them being energy sucks versus where we'll be 50 years from now?
Yeah, I do not believe the current status of data centers will remain. Mm-hmm. They will become more efficient. They will become smaller. They're already, if you already look at some of the data centers that are already being planned in more urban areas, they're a lot smaller mm-hmm. already. And the secret is that there have been data centers all scattered throughout Ohio for decades now.
We're just noticing them more.
We're just noticing them now. And even those first generation, second generation ones now are shrinking in size now when you look at what's going to be planned next. Mm-hmm. And the energy intensity is going to shrink because of just the integration of various technologies from computer exchange sort of campuses that produce power and sort of are able to sort of trade power and hold batteries and things like that that are going to be used for them to improvements in water and water usage, which we're doing a lot of work with those kind of companies as well, all throughout the country, but especially here in Ohio and in Northeast Ohio.
Well, just to end on, if you had a magic wand to put more federal or state investment, more money behind something, where would you put it?
How much longer do we have?
Yeah.
I would say we need to make sure we put more of this, more federal and state money into a few different buckets, but mainly into the innovation space in which people are bringing jobs, broader tax base to the forefront. That's going to be critical. Making sure that we have the right siting, making sure we have the right regulatory regulatory landscape that allows for ease of investment from the private sector. Also making sure we have enough, the right regulatory landscape that allows for ease of investment and giving from the nonprofit and philanthropic sectors. And then also allowing and also providing and backing up places and spaces where entrepreneurs can go and receive the services to root their ideas, their businesses, and their innovations, and the subsequent benefits of those right here in Ohio. That's what we need.
We have been talking about supporting energy innovators by supporting startups with new ideas, and we've been talking with the CEO of Wright Energy Innovators, Jade Davis. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk about bringing technology to a rural school district. That's when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday from All Sides with Amy Jurevich, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. A new Ohio investment is creating opportunities for rural students to access career-oriented tech education. This funding from the state is allowing TechCorps to provide its services to Taos Valley Schools. TechCorps is a nonprofit program that provides engaging technology lessons for K-12 students. And joining us now is TechCorps CEO, Lisa Chambers. Welcome back to All Sides, Lisa.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And also joining us is the Director of Teaching and Learning at Taos Valley School District, Beth Kepler. Welcome to All Sides, Beth.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, Lisa, rural areas have historically lacked funding and the technology to do certain things. Can you tell us what is this career-oriented tech education that you're able to bring to Taos Valley?
Well, thanks again for allowing us to be here and talk about a program that I'm so excited about. We have wanted for a number of years to work with schools in more rural communities. But the way our funding was structured, we really were focused on our large urban areas. But we knew that there was a need there, there was an interest there. And so we were so grateful to the state for making this investment, which is allowing us to expand our student tech corps, our registered pre-apprenticeship program, to high schools in small and rural communities around the state of Ohio. So Taos Valley is getting us started, but the hope is that we will continue to grow this program and be able to reach more students.
And Beth, did Taos Valley reach out to TechCorps or did TechCorps find you?
We reached out to TechCorps. Mm-hmm. We've got a history of working with them over time. So when we saw this opportunity, out there. It felt like it would be a great partnership.
So Beth, what is TechCore bringing to the table that you did not have the capacity to do or the money to do before?
Well, TechCore just has those relationships, you know, well connected with industry. When you're a school district in a rural area, it's really hard to stay on top of industry needs, making sure that curriculum writing, courses that you're offering are aligned. And TechCore has always done such a great job of being on top of those things. And then I always call them just a great translator. So, you know, they can help schools, especially, you know, smaller schools in rural areas. This is where it's just so helpful for them to be able to bring their level knowledge to us, to those classroom teachers, so that we can develop these programs for students.
All right. So, Lisa, tell us about a program that's actually happening in Taze Valley. So what are the students learning? What are they doing?
Sure. So Student Tech Corps kind of puts students in almost like a simulated work environment. So they are moving through curriculum that's focused around tech support. So learning about everything from building computers, supporting computers, networks, databases, all of that. And there's also a strong durable skills component. So all those skills that employers are saying are important for students to have. So we provide the curriculum and the support. So we've trained a teacher in Taze Valley who is running this as a class with a group of students for a number of different periods. Those students move through the curriculum and the labs, and then they also go through a testing and certification process. So they have an opportunity to earn a registered pre-apprenticeship certificate, the Ohio Means Jobs Readiness Seal, work-based learning hours, and then finally an industry-recognized credential. So it brings with it a lot of different components, and all of these things now in the state of Ohio also help students meet graduation requirements.
And Beth, are we talking high school students for you? Is this who's doing it? Okay. And are we talking about what Lisa just outlined? Is that happening during the school day, or is this extracurricular?
No, it's happening during the school day.
Okay.
So we have one school period set aside.
And do students sign up to be in that class, or is everyone in a certain grade level doing it?
No, students definitely elect to take the class. Mm-hmm. We go through it's this time of year as we're getting ready even for next school year, marketing that, making sure our students see the alignment to workforce, the demand that's there. So yes, we definitely recruit students into the program, but as Lisa said, we have several periods first semester that we ran the course, and then a second cohort of students came in and started when school resumed second semester.
Okay. And Lisa, what are we talking here? Are they learning to do coding, AI, something else? Give me an example of what they're learning.
So this particular program that they're doing is focused on tech support. So basically, they're learning how to run a tech support operation. So much like what might happen here or any other business.
So they can fix my laptop?
Could fix your laptop and probably a number of other things too. So the way that this can be really unique, Amy, in some of our small rural districts is they may have had the funding to purchase a lot of equipment, but didn't have that same funding to hire that staff to support that equipment. For schools, this can become a real resource for them in empowering. So if you think back to maybe, I don't know if you're old enough to remember, like the AV club.
I remember an AV right? club, yes.
So this is like the high-tech AV club, right? So we have students in our schools who are on the ground providing real support. They might be going, one of the schools, districts that we're in, the high school is across the street from the elementary school. The high school students are going across the street and helping the elementary school teachers get their technology set up. So again,
I know a lot of elementary school teachers who have to spend a whole day with Chromebooks and passwords with little kids. That would help.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it provides real skills, right, for our young people. So they're getting to see how what they've learned in the class applies to the real world and how it's applicable. And they're starting to build their resume, their work portfolio in high school.
And Beth, you mentioned having a dedicated teacher, a dedicated class period to this. Were you able to hire someone new, or was it a teacher you already had and he or she learned more new things?
Yes, it was a teacher we already had, but you know, we really stepped back looking at some of the courses they were teaching. And that was another reason I reached out to TechCore. We wanted students to be able to leave with truly building a resume, you know, getting in a true pre-apprenticeship, getting in some of those credentials. And so we just took a course and we reimagined it in a way to make it even better.
So it's kind of like if the course had been around for a long time, it was more like an AV club and you kind of moved it into 2026.
Yes, that's exactly what we did.
Got it. And how many do you have a number? How many students are taking it or completed it?
I think in the first semester we had around 60. And then this semester, it's about, I think, one full section. So I think 30. So
this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about technology education with TechCore CEO Lisa Chambers and the Director of Teaching and Learning at Taze Valley School District, Beth Kepler. So, Lisa, do you see the tech focus changing and expanding all the time? Like when you set up this curriculum, do you need to go into Taze Valley every year and change it, or is it pretty malleable, I guess is where, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, with all of our Tech Core programs, we're constantly looking at our curriculum and making updates. So Student Tech Core now has three versions. So the tech support is one of the versions. We have another that's focused on web development. And this year we'll be rolling out one on AI. So as an organization, we're in constant spin in terms of our curriculum. And I think the thing that's exciting is that as a nonprofit in this space, we can move quickly in making those changes around curriculum and then bring that into schools as a partner and as a supporter.
Now, it was a $100,000 investment from the state that made this possible for you to expand from your urban school districts to rural school districts. Is that one-time money or is it forever money?
Well, we should hope that it's forever. But that was that's a 2-year, it's $100,000 a year for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So we're in the state budget. So, and with that, our goal to reach 200 students. So we're getting started with Taze Valley. We also are working in Sheridan as well. And we'll be adding new school districts in this next school year.
Okay, so 200 students. So Beth just mentioned, I think she said 60 plus 30. So
we'll probably be over.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Taze Valley is awesome. And we're going to go, I mean, again, I think our long-term goal for Tech Core in the next 5 years is we really want to get to 5,000 students in small and rural communities across the state of Ohio. So that's going to take more than the state investment, but we hope that this is going to be a great way of showing what's possible, that there is a need, and that we've got students that can achieve incredible things with this.
Did the money in the state budget come with any strings attached? Do you have to work with certain rural areas or did you get to pick?
We're getting to pick. Again, the focus was just schools that are designated by the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce as either small or rural.
Okay. Beth, tell me some things that you've seen in the students. What have they learned? What are they gaining?
Well, just seeing that this work is relevant and that it has meaning. So when you can connect, there's a huge demand for skilled IT in the workforce. And, you know, this program, the curriculum, the tasks they're doing help students see that relevancy. And so they're thinking about ways, even if they're not considering a career in IT, they're really seeing how this work, this troubleshooting that, you know, Lisa's talking about, it applies across many different sectors and industries.
Do they tell stories about going home and being able to fix their parents' computer or help their younger sibling? Yeah,
I'm sure they're pulled into that work a lot more now, given their skill set they've gotten through this course.
Tell me what it means to them if they are interested in a tech career, or even if they don't know what they want to be when they grow up because they're still young. What does it mean to have these certificates? Do they understand that it is a good thing for their resume, even if they're young and don't have a resume?
Absolutely. And that was one of the things last spring when I reached out. It was actually early June. We had some IT courses here. And like I mentioned, they just really need refreshed, updated, et cetera. But we had a few graduates that came back to us and said, look, you know, I'm going out there. I'm trying to build my resume, but, you know, I don't know what to add to this, et cetera. And I reached out to Lisa at that time. And so we've really been able to share, you know, some of our students are aware of some of our alumni, you know, they know of their interests, and now being able to share, look, you know, we've put these things in place, you know, working with Tech Core so that you can build your resume, so that these, you know, credentials can, you know, help you. And they're really seeing that and appreciate that.
Lisa, talk to me about going into talking to a teacher, like a teacher at a school district who has had a class that they've been teaching in a certain way for a certain number of years. Do you ever have to like lean on them a little bit to be like, let's change this and here's how?
Really, we haven't. I think, you know, and you can hear it in Beth, is that I think our schools are open and ready to try new things. I think when they can find a partner that meets them, our curriculum design team is a blended group of computer scientists and teachers. So they know what it's like to be in the classroom, and they're really intentional about how they build our curriculum, how they build the supports for the teacher that we work with. And it's not we're not in and out. You know, we really are a partner for the long term. We also are really focused on not just building a one-size-fits-all, but really working closely with our schools to figure out what their situation is, what we can bring in, and then how we can customize it to meet their needs. So far we haven't had to drag anyone to the water. I think that schools know that these are skills that kids need. And as Beth said, regardless if they, you know, grow up and decide to become, you know, data engineers or software developers, these are skills now that kids just need, that folks just need to operate in our society. And we need to do a better job of just making sure that these skills are accessible to all.
Did your Tech Corps trainer go to Taze Valley, or did the teacher come to you for learning?
You know what? Eventually, we will bring all of our teachers together. So because we're still starting small, our vision is that eventually we bring all the teachers together in the summer. They go through their training and then go into their school year with that support. It also helps them to build community with teachers from other districts. So again, my vision is that we have several schools in this upcoming school year that are participating, and that we're really starting to build a community of practice around this. So those teachers not only are receiving support from Tech Corps, but they're also building community with other teachers in other districts who are running this program so they can learn from them.
Talk to me about this AI course you're developing, because AI is changing by the day. And different school districts, I mean, I think the state of Ohio is requiring them to have some sort of AI policy by a certain date or whatever, but you have to like adapt to that by the minute. How are you developing an AI course for students in this world?
Well, I'm excited to say, so Tech Corps built its own AI policy and also a position statement around what we believe about AI and how it should be integrated into the teaching and learning process, what that means for students and what that means for educators. So certainly we've been aware of the AI policy, and I was really happy when we kind of lined what the policy said and what our position statement said. There was a lot of alignment. Mm-hmm. So that means for us that we're headed in the right direction in terms of the way that we're thinking about this. And, you know, the AI pre-apprenticeship program, I can't tell you a whole lot about it because I don't want to start talking about things that I don't know enough about for my team.
It's not ready yet.
Let me bring someone else in here. Yeah. But I will tell you that it is in alignment with how we think about our programs across the board, in that we're moving kids and we want kids to understand these tools, understand the way they work, understand the way that they engage with them, and to become creators and designers around using these tools. And that will be the same as we think about the work that we'll do with AI, both for our students, but we're also building some professional development for educators in the same space.
And Beth, at Taze Valley, do you see this this curriculum that you're doing? And, you know, I know it's new, it hasn't even been around for, you know, a full year yet, but can Taze Valley continue to do it? I don't know if Tech Corps will stay with you forever, but can you keep it going?
Absolutely, right. We put the whole program together with sustainability in mind. And again, it's that general idea that IT is everywhere. Mm-hmm. So, you know, rural communities, if you haven't been inside a tractor during spring or fall, you don't realize, I mean, the amount of sensors, the amount of iPads, the amount of data they're collecting, you know, GPS guided steering systems, et cetera. It's relevant, and it's going to remain relevant. So, you know, it's definitely important to us to sustain this program long term.
Did you have money at Taze Valley to, I don't know if you needed to buy new computers, new iPads, did you need new tech to do this better?
No, I mean, what for us, it was the teacher, you know, and most schools have to kind of step back. And that's where I think the support that Tech Corps provides, it's just invaluable, because, you know, you can step back, you can take a classroom teacher that has the desire, but maybe doesn't have the skill set. It doesn't take a ton of money to implement. And usually schools have you know, most of the equipment to do this, you likely have. It's really about the curriculum and how you approach that equipment. So,
can I jump in on that too? And I would just say that we were very intentional about building a program that didn't require a lot of investment because we want schools to be able to maintain. We didn't. So when the design team is thinking about the curriculum that or the program we're building for everyone, those are the things that they're considering, right? And so even with this program, the students are doing, instead of having to have actual equipment, the students are doing a lot of simulated builds and labs. So they're still learning the skills, they're still learning how the pieces go, but instead of having maybe a physical computer sitting in front of them, they're able to do these labs online and take advantage of the learning that way.
We have been talking about some state money that's being used by Tech Core to bring their program to rural school districts. And we've been talking with Tech Core CEO Lisa Chambers. Thanks for being here today, Lisa.
Thank you.
And we've also been talking with the Director of Teaching and Learning at Taze Valley School District, Beth Kaplar. Beth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And coming up on Tech Tuesday, we are going to learn about Apple's Creator Studio. It's very similar to Adobe's. That is when Tech Tuesday from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. This is Tech Tuesday, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Apple has launched a Creator Studio where you can use all of their creator tools under one subscription. But the concept sounds very similar to Adobe's existing Creative Cloud. And Verizon is facing some backlash from their recent blackout. Joining us to talk about these tech stories and more is the Director of Commerce Content at CNET, Russell Hawley. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
So Apple has launched their Creator Studio. It's a bundle of apps. What is included in this bundle?
There's quite a few things included in here, and some of these may sound like familiar names to folks who have been in the Apple ecosystem for a while because they are apps that Apple has been steadily acquiring over the last 10 years. So first is the image manipulation app called Pixelmator Pro, which is their kind of Photoshop-esque set of tools. It is certainly not as complex and feature-rich as as Adobe's Photoshop, but it is very close and you know, good enough for quite a few people. This is part of a system that it calls Main Stage, which allows this tool to be used alongside an app called Freeform for creating illustrations and graphics. And then there's a fair bit in the way of video and music apps like Logic Pro and Chord ID, as well as Final Cut, Motion, and Compressor. That are all, you know, in one way or another geared towards creating either photos, music, or video.
So Apple had all of these and you had to pay for them all separately, but now they're bundling them. Is that what's new?
You could choose to pay for them all separately, or you could choose to like just pay for the app and not any of the existing kind of cloud architecture that existed behind it. So you could and still can purchase just Pixelmator Pro. I think it's $40, and it's kind of not bound to the Apple ecosystem. So you just want to use it on your computer, you still can. And the same is true for a lot of these. What you're getting with this bundle is it's all of the apps that I just listed together. It's $13 a month or $130 a year. And it includes, Apple's cloud backup between devices. So if you've got, one of these apps on your phone and one on your laptop and one on a desktop, then things that you're working on will sync across them.
Now, how does that compare with Adobe's Creative Cloud? I'm not sure. Because of where I work, Adobe is, Ohio State buys in bulk. So I don't know how much it costs for an individual person.
Yeah, so I mean, Adobe's Creative Cloud has a ton of different options, including discounts for bulk purchases and for students. But the kind of lowest version of the Creative Cloud service that you can go for is $42 a month for Creative Cloud Pro. You can buy the individual apps and pay monthly for them separately. So if you just care about Photoshop, then Photoshop itself is $23 a month, which is still quite a bit more than what Apple is charging for this.
So is Apple trying to lure over some Adobe Creative Cloud people? You know, I don't know if you've been using Adobe for a long time. I don't know what the transition will be like, but it sounds like Apple is trying to make it cheaper.
Yeah, the transition for any of these tools is not going to be easy. There is no kind of one-to-one translation between Photoshop and Pixelmator, for example, but there's quite a bit that you can do inside of both. And yes, this is very much Apple has been leaning really hard on subscription services for quite some time now. Not just with streaming movies and music, but it's cloud services and how those things kind of interact with the rest of the Apple ecosystem. And so this is very much a way to keep as many creative people as possible, in the Apple ecosystem without feeling the need to switch to other platforms.
And I feel like Adobe for years though has had kind of a lock on this. This is their thing. Can Apple break in because they're Apple and that's what they do?
I think Apple can break in very specific situations. I think that there are ways in which things like the Creator Studio can be useful for artists who have one very specific drive and they want to move in that direction. As this service improves and continues, I can see somebody who isn't a decade or more into using Photoshop feeling like they can make that switch and not have it be particularly expensive. I also think this is a great opportunity for folks who are just entering college or just entering high school to have just a less expensive set of tools that they can use to do things. That's not going to help in a graphic design course, which is going to be almost entirely Adobe based because that's what the curriculum has been for so long. But this is very much a step in the right direction for Apple to pull people away from the Adobe services.
Do you think this will make Adobe make theirs a little bit cheaper?
Absolutely not.
No,
I
oh,
think
absolutely not. Okay.
no, I think that if Adobe's going to lower their prices, it would be because there was a significant change in how many users were there. So if Adobe reported next year that 30% of its users left for the Apple service, then we would probably see some changes. But otherwise, I don't see that happening anytime soon.
This is Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about recent tech news with Russell Hawley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Sticking with Apple for a minute, Apple has officially chosen Google's Gemini for Siri. Last we checked, OpenAI was still an option. So why did they end up with Gemini, did they say?
Yeah, so the relationship between Apple and OpenAI has always been not exactly clear. When Apple first announced Apple Intelligence last year and started hanging billboards all over the place for this kind of nebulous thing that was definitely AI, but not all the way AI, the way that Apple was trying to kind of have both things at the same time. The deal was that Siri would be able to handle, kind of your basic set of questions that it can answer right now. And if it was something that was more complicated or more specific, then there would be an option to pass that question off to OpenAI to get the answer that you're looking for and to have it come back. But Apple maintained this pretty specific dividing line between Siri and the OpenAI platform. This is a very different agreement. This is you will experience Siri, you will use Siri, but the name Gemini is just not going to show up. Google is essentially licensing the algorithms that allow Gemini to answer questions to Apple, so that Siri will be the very pretty layer on top, but the actual computing power for answering questions and grabbing data is going to be maintained by Google.
Okay, so most people won't know that Google's underneath this, but what they want is Siri to work better. Will it work better?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And the idea here is that this would work better. This is actually not the first time that Apple and Google have had versions of this relationship. Google has been the default search engine for most Apple products for a very long time because Apple attempted to make its own search engine and it didn't work out very well. And so, Google became the default for a lot of those technologies, even if it wasn't, kind of plastered right there on the page. And so this is a you know, an extension, significant though it may be, an extension of that relationship.
Does that mean, do you mean like Google is underneath Safari? Like, isn't Apple's thing Safari?
Exactly. Yeah. If you type, you know, just in the search bar in Safari, it will take you to Google.
Oh, well, I didn't even know that. And that's exactly what they want, right? They want Siri and Safari to be their thing, but Google's running it. They're paying Google to make it better.
That's exactly right. Yeah. This, you know, there have been versions of this relationship for quite some time now, and this is very much the extension of that. But this is also something that OpenAI very much wanted to be in this position. And so it continues this, you know, kind of back and forth jockeying for which one of these platforms is going to be seen as the best of the AI platforms. And it really is at the moment boiling down to kind of five major choices, depending on the kind of thing that you're using AI chatbots for.
Okay. So when will this be fully integrated? When will we see changes for Siri?
We will likely hear changes regarding, you know, Siri's capabilities with the launch of the next version of iOS later this year. So there will be a developer conference where Apple announces all of the things that are going to come to the next version of iOS. And we will hear quite a bit how AI has been baked into those tools at that time, all in time for it to be rolled into the next iPhone when it comes out in the fall.
Okay. Our final topic for today is last Wednesday, Verizon had an hours-long outage that impacted more than 2 million people. Can you tell us what happened? Because I'm going to just preface this by saying it did not impact me, and I live in Columbus, Ohio, so it didn't impact Columbus, and I did not know about it until after it was over. So...
this is something that appeared to impact a pretty significant part of the Eastern Seaboard and then also Texas. You know, what that kind of dividing line is entirely based on, you know, how Verizon's network architecture exists. And they're not incredibly forthcoming about what specifically has gone wrong here. But what we know is that for about a 5-hour period, there were right around 2 million customers who either had no ability to text or call at all, or had extremely limited capabilities when it came to calling and text. In many cases, data was still available, but not entirely. But it was a massive disruption, and it was a disruption for much longer than has been seen at that scale in a really long time.
5 hours is a long time to...
Yes.
So when you say it's longer than ever, like, has previous outages been maybe an hour or two, but never approaching that long?
Yeah, there are services that track these kind of things that are publicly available to everyone. My personal favorite is one called Down Detector, where you can just kind of go and say, you know, oh, hey, it's not just me. This website is actually down. And it does that for services as well. Down Detector reported that the last time there was any outage from Verizon that lasted that long was 7 years ago, and it didn't impact nearly this many people.
Mm. So Verizon is saying they're sorry and they're offering compensation to customers. What's that look like?
This is going to look like a $20 credit to your account. If you were in an area that you were impacted, you'll need to opt in using the My Verizon app. So you have to go into the My Verizon app and let them know that you were impacted by this outage, which seems somewhat anathema because Verizon probably knows who was impacted by this, but they're hoping that not everyone will speak up. And so you can go into the My Verizon app and you can opt into this thing. And on your next bill statement, there will be a $20 credit issued.
Is $20 a good thing? Is Verizon doing a good job here? What was public reaction like to that?
You know, there's never, you know, a very long time ago, I have, you know, worked in similar customer service where there was, you know, kind of outages that I had to explain. And there is never a human being who wants to hear that the prorated amount of, you know, a single day in a 30-day period of being out of service, you know, is not an entire month's bill worth of service that you have paid for. So, you know, I'm sure that $20 is a pretty weak Band-Aid for folks who felt like they were really inconvenienced for most of a working day. But you know, this is, you know, more, you know, $20 in many cases is more than what the actual cost of the service for 5 hours would be.
Yeah. And Verizon didn't say what caused the outage, did they? Is it possible they don't know what happened?
It is unlikely that Verizon knows doesn't know what happened, but it is certainly something that they're being very careful about talking about for the immediate future. It is likely that there will be a full report published at some point to kind of detail how this works and you know what specifically went down and what steps Verizon has taken to make sure that this doesn't happen in the future. But for the now, for the immediate future, we're largely in the dark. There are quite a few engineering specialists who have speculated as to what the cause might be, but it is there is absolutely nothing that can be verified right now.
Okay, it wasn't. But did they say it wasn't anything as dramatic as like a data hack or anything like that? Was it like a broken piece of technology, most likely, not a bad, you know, hack?
Yeah, so far we haven't seen anything to suggest network penetration or, you know, an attack from a foreign source or a domestic source or anything like that. It also seems unlikely that this was someone who accidentally tripped over a power cord somewhere. Like there was something on a
yeah.
That's right. There is something on a fairly significant level that happened. You know, because it wasn't just one city, it wasn't just one, you know, kind of regionality. In many cases, it was almost the entirety of the Eastern Seaboard. So that is, you know, far more than, say, a single data center having a problem. This was an issue at a fairly significant scale for Verizon.
Okay. It was Verizon. Unplug it and plug it back in. Everything will be fine.
That's right.
All right. We've been talking about tech with Russell Holley, Director of Commerce Content at CNET. Thanks so much, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
And this has been Tech Tuesday from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us today.